Welcome to episode 11 of the Olasky Interview, brought to you by listener-supported World Radio. I'm your host, Jill Nelson. Today, we'll listen in on Marvin's 2017 interview with Fox News religion reporter Lauren Green. Green studied journalism at Northwestern University's acclaimed Medill School of Journalism. She also wrote a 2017 book titled Lighthouse Faith. You'll hear her discuss that in her conversation with Marvin today. And here now to preview that discussion is World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky. Hello, Marvin.
Hey, Jill.
Well, this isn't the first time you interviewed Green, is it?
No.
When else have you spoken with her, and what was that like?
Well, I had the privilege and pleasure of living in New York City for 3.5 years or so, and that's when occasionally we talked about stuff, because she's the Fox religion reporter, and very knowledgeable, and so it was a natural thing that that occasionally I'd ask her questions, she'd ask me questions.
Well, that's an interesting beat to have. Did she talk a lot about the challenges that that presented for her?
Oh, big time. I mean, number one, do people who are secular think this is important at all? Why should they care? And then number two, the tendency in journalism is to emphasize anger and controversy. And she really wanted to explain things and teach and let people understand where other folks are coming from. So I think there was always the pressure to juice it up a little bit in terms of controversy. So she's really more of a teacher than someone who's just out for clicks or excitement in television.
I assume these interviews indicate your respect for Green's work as a journalist. What does she do well?
She's smart. She understands religions, including Christianity. And particularly, she sees the pathos of life. That is, it's not just celebration. It's not just Easter. You have to have Good Friday first. And she conveys that well. When I asked her at one point who you would really like to interview, she talks about from Old Testament characters interviewing Joseph and Moses about their prison time, their exiles, their disappointments. That's important to understand in a religion if you're not going to fall into triumphalism or prosperity gospel stuff.
What part of this interview did you find most interesting?
Just her work as a journalist and how she tries to think Christianly about the journalism she's doing. And then also, and I can't remember now whether we got into it in this particular interview, but we've talked about her music talent, her understanding, and the way that things in the universe fit together. Just the notes, the scale, how this in God's plan works out in a way that produces some magic in music and singing. She's very musical and thinks about that and tries to apply scripture to even music as she applies it to other parts of life.
Well, before we get started, I have to ask this question. What was she like in person? I mean, she just sounds like a fascinating woman who's gifted in many different areas. What was it like to meet her?
Well, I don't want to be specializing in Miss America contestants, but she was Miss Minnesota, and I think she was third runner-up in a Miss America contest. So she still has that elegance, that grace. She's a beautiful person externally and internally. And so it was a pleasure just to talk with her and follow. When I see one of her stories, I learn from it. And that's something I can't say about all religion reporters.
Well, it's exciting to hear the difference that she's making and where she's at and how God's uniquely placed her for such a time as this. Thanks, Marvin.
Thank you.
The Olasky Interview is a production of World Radio and is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. Comprehensive ministry training for the next generation of pastors, missionaries, and church leaders. More at swbts.edu. And from the Tony Evans Training Center, an online learning platform bringing biblical studies to your computer or smart device, tonyevanstraining.org. And from Covenant College, equipping students to learn, lead, and live as Christians. Visit covenant.edu. Here now is that interview with Fox News religion reporter Lauren Green. This conversation took place in 2017 before a live audience at Patrick Henry College.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming, Lauren.
It's great to be here. Wow.
Yeah, and congratulations on your first book coming out officially on Tuesday.
Yeah, my husband commented, it's like, oh, we should have had the picture of the book up there, or that at least that photo up there. We'll get it to you.
Well, in the book, you talk a lot about, you talk about your life, but then the theology that really pushes you on right now. But let me ask, going back, okay, you're youngest of five.
Yes.
So you had lots of sort of parental figures, big brothers, big sisters. How was that being the youngest?
I don't think I would call them parental figures.
All right.
Older brothers and sisters. Yeah. You don't know any different. I don't know any different than being the youngest of five children. But my oldest sister is old enough to be, she was 17 when I was born. So for me, she was already an adult. The older two were already adults and out of the house by the time I really could recollect who was who in the family. And so it was the younger three that really became the core. My older brother, Kenny, who died a few years ago of cancer, and I mentioned in the book. And then also my sister Lois, who's just 2 years apart. So we're essentially kind of grew together. So I don't really think of it as a huge family, because it's like three separate kind of families. Yeah. The two oldest, the one, and then the two old, and then to the younger, but the same parents, who go through different phases in their lives.
Did you grow up going to church?
I did. I grew up going to church, Sunday school, going to, celebrating Easter and Christmas, and I remember being in the Christmas play and all of those things. And I talk about my great aunt Retha, who was a Sunday school teacher. But I think I was, and I've been talking about this, and I think when I grew up, it was just a different era. And I realized so much of my younger days was sort of breathing the air of Christianity, because the culture was infused with Christian beliefs, Christian understanding of the world. And so I think that's what I understood. And one of the things that I did not say in the book, which I'd like to say, because it kind of sets up why the book had took so long, is when I was about 18 or 19. And I remember asking the question to a fellow student at the University of Minnesota, and I more or less asked it to myself, I think. But I said, what is the question that answers every other question? What is the one question? I mean, and somehow my brain was trying to focus on something that I knew was just one thing that answered everything else. And I believed in God, but see, God wasn't part of that scenario. And somebody asked me a few weeks ago, when you asked your parents that question, what did they say? It's like, I didn't ask my parents. At 18 or 19, you're done asking your parents things, right?
Right.
If your parents want to influence your life, they better do it when you're about 8 or 9, not when you're 18 or 19. But I think that because I asked the question so earnestly, and I believe God in his wisdom really worked in my life. And he says, I'm going to answer that question for you, but I'm going to answer it over decades. I'm not going to just give you the answer right now, so that you will know the answer to this question, and it will be certain, and it will be firm, and it will be your foundational trust when you finally get that question answered. And I believe the book is really the working out of that.
And so knowing the answer, or part of the answer, or learning the answer, did that make a difference in how you lived when you went to the University of Minnesota?
I think so. I think, I think the era, the culture around you was so influential. And I remember having so many spiritual conversations with young people about who God is and what sin is, and how that, influenced my life. I thought I knew everything. I thought that my emotions ruled, and if I felt it, it was good. And these are the things that sort of infiltrated the culture at that time. And those are the things that I understood. But I still understood that there was a God that cared. And I don't know how I really knew that, because I separated my understanding of God from the relationship with God. God was the Santa Claus in the sky. God was the thing you called on when things got bad. God, why are you doing this to me? Why? What are you trying to teach me? Why don't you, do what, I pray to you to do? Why don't you give me this?
A cosmic bellhop?
Yes, the cosmic bellhop, the Santa Claus in the sky, if you're good, why can't you stop all of this? That kind of thing. I think it's a very short-sighted way of understanding God. And I think most of us kind of learn God from the Sunday school kind of God of the Jesus stories, you know, of Jesus loving the little children, of, you know, the lilies, and, you know, the Jesus with, you know, curly locks and a white flowing robe. And we don't see the bloody Jesus on a cross and the broken Jesus and the angry Jesus and a lot of the things that really take the Sunday school understanding of Christianity and bridge that gap to the real real theological relationship with Jesus Christ. That is different. And I think at some point, kids kind of lose that. They don't kind of get through that, you know, real life issue. Somehow they just, you know, parents get tired of telling your kids to go to church, or the parents don't understand. So I think that's part of the issue. But, you know, like today I think about, and I wish I'd read Mere Christianity when I was 18. I wish I'd read the Screwtape Letters. I wish that, you know, I understood things like that, you know, that I understand now. And, but, so it's a different kind of upbringing.
So, I mean, a lot of the students here have read, let's say, C.S. Lewis,
yes,
the Screwtape Letters, and so forth. But is it harder to apply until you have more life experience to see how this actually does work out in practice?
I'm not sure, because I wonder to myself, had I read Mere Christianity when I was 18 or 19, would it have had the same impact that it has on me today? Because at 18 or 19, was I ready to hear certain things about how I was leading my life? And I don't think I was. And as I read the Bible through year after year, I mean, I've read the Bible through, you know, several times now, because, you know, you have the one year Bible and you just keep reading and reading, and so you read it through several times. And each year, certain verses will say something to me they didn't say to me years before. So I think it's the same effect, where it depends on where you are in your life. That will determine how you interpret certain things coming towards you. And also, I believe that God wants to reveal certain things to you at a certain time, because he knows you're ready to hear it now, and before you really weren't ready to hear it.
Okay, then you get into pageant life, beauty pageants. Maybe, what's that lifestyle like?
Pageants are very interesting things, because the public sees one thing, but participants see something else and experience something else. The public sees the gowns and the swimsuits and the walking on the runway, and the pageant participants see, you know, the scrambling to get the hair done and the makeup done, and the stress and the insecurity, or, you know, the practicing, the what if, can I win, I need, you know, all of these things that build inside of you something different. You're growing. And so I always say that the benefits of pageants are not the scholarships you win or the being the center of attention, but the personal growth that I experienced. And I think I experienced more personal growth losing a pageant than I ever did winning one. And I have said this before, and I think I might have said it in this book, you know, if your fear of losing is greater than your desire to win, that becomes between a rock and a hard place. And that's where pageants taught me to just throw off the fear of losing and go through and just say, I did not die from losing from this pain, and it made me stronger. I mean, that's the whole phrase, you know, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. And I think that's kind of the process. But I think that all of us experience the stress of pageants in life, but on a very different kind of level, right? Because when you are in the real world, you are competing against other people for jobs, for relationships. But let's just take the job world. You're competing against people for jobs, and you're being judged on sometimes very subjective things, whether or not you know it. The difference is, in a pageant, is that your competitors are right in front of you. You know exactly what they're doing. When you're in a job interview, you may not know who the other person is, or that they're competing against, and who they are choosing over you for whatever reasons. And it could be a very subjective reason, has nothing to do with your skills. So pageant teaches you to sort of go forward in the best that you can be, whether or not it's good enough to be chosen as the winner, it doesn't matter, because being the best you can be then becomes the goal that's attainable.
So editors tell reporters who are frustrated at times, I'm not rejecting you, I'm rejecting a piece of paper at this point.
Right. Okay.
So a little harder with a pageant when you're right there. And
well, I think that's what it is. It's like you learn that it is not about rejecting you per se. I mean, it's easy to kind of go there. But I think anybody who has competed in a pageant for a very long time, or a few pageants, understands that some days it's just going to be your day. You know, and you've seen young women compete in pageants time after time again. I mean, I was in 9 pageants over the course of my pageant, you know, career, and I won like 3. So from the just odds, I would be seen as a loser, but I don't think I'm a loser. You just kind of, okay, that didn't work that time. That dress was wrong. So let's go and do it again and do it differently. I mean, I'd know people who were, you know, became Miss Minnesota 2 years before that. They didn't even make the top 10 in the pageant. How can I make this different? Learn from your mistakes. It's not that you're not right. It's that you're not right now. And that's the difference you learn.
And if you don't run, you can't win.
If you don't run, you can't win. And if you don't learn from your mistake, you're not going to win. I mean, granted, not everybody can be Miss America. I wasn't Miss America, but I got pretty close. But it certainly didn't daunt my ego at all. I still think I was worth it because I still became better than I was before.
You're third runner-up. In fact, you can go on YouTube and see Lauren playing Chopin. That was your piano talent. I mean, real talent.
You still can, wow.
Still can, still there. Saw it last night.
I think I would cringe, though, if I saw it. It's like, ooh, okay.
But, okay, let's get to some of the people you talk about in your book, including your great-aunt Rita.
Yes.
And the game of bunkum.
I know. That bunkum is really now becoming sort of this word out there now because it was this game that she taught us when we were little.
What are the rules of bunkum?
The rules of bunkum is, is a game that my great-aunt Rita played with us, is that she would hide a everyday object like a comb or a brush or a knife or a fork or something in a room, but you'd hide it in plain sight. And then, we would go out of the room, my sister and I, and while she was hiding, and then we'd come back in and we'd look for the item. And you didn't have to like move anything because it was hiding in plain sight. You just had to find it. And whoever found it would just say bunkum and sit down and let the other person look. And then it was like so frustrating. I remember looking for this item forever, but my sister already found it. It's like, oh, I can't believe I can't find this item. And then finally went like, ah, I said bunkum and I found it. And it was the interesting thing about it. And I use that analogy in there because it finally, so it's like, you know what? I think God was playing this sort of cosmic game of bunkum with us, you know? He's hiding in plain sight.
Did she tell you what kind of object you're looking for? Or was it just some object that wasn't
there
before?
She'd hold the comb in front of us, or the brush, or whatever it was. This is what I'm hiding. So you knew what you were looking for. We'd go out of the room, she would hide it, and then you'd come back and you'd try to find it.
So I'm just wondering, do you see from your vantage point any common item like a book as you look out here, a particular book that might be near and dear to you? I don't know if, can you see any angle?
There's the book, yes.
That's the book. You could, hold it. There's, yeah. Anyway, so congratulations, bunkum.
Thank you.
okay, talking about some people. You went to high school, you mentioned, with Prince.
You've been not in the book. I didn't mention it.
Not in the book.
But everybody knows that now, yes.
Okay.
I did go to high school with Prince, and I hate to say that now because, of course, it dates me. But then I have to, be, you know, because we went to the same, grew up in the same neighborhood, so we went to the same high school.
Right. Yes, this is not in the book, but I have read that in the 6th grade, he called you to say, I like you.
Yes.
And you hung up on him.
Yes, I did. Because in the 6th grade, it was not cool to like boys. So he called me and he says, I like you. And he's like, and I hung up on him. And I regret that. And I regret that even now because I never was able to tell him that before he passed away. And I think that's one of those things that just will kind of be hard to, because I'd like to say I'm sorry that I probably shouldn't have done that. But we actually repaired some of that because he actually asked me to be in one of his videos later on in life. So.
Okay, and you did it?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
So. All right. More serious now, your brother Kenny.
Yeah.
He died in 2009.
Yeah, of cancer. And You know, Kenny was an artist, painter, but he was also security guard and worked at Home Depot. Could, you know, put up tiles and. But his death was just, it's very, you know, when my father died, you're kind of prepared for it because it's a parent and he had cancer and it was time and it was still hard. But my brother, this is someone who's just like me. This is the same gene pool. This is the guy that, you know, we had fights with and he babysat us and then, you know, and all of the things that you remember growing up of that person, and then you see them so weak and frail. But I remember that journey he had, and he went to a, the nuns actually asked, allowed him to come to their convent to have sort of a respite and a time for reflection. And he talked about how he had grown so close to God at that point that he would not ask for more life and give up that relationship with God. It had become so powerful for him that life was great, but that relationship with God was so powerful and so wonderful that he would not ask for more life in exchange for that relationship.
And it was actually the cancer that pushed him into a deeper relationship? Was that?
I think that he was always in a deep relationship with God because he, in some of his artwork, he did paintings of the various scenes from the Old Testament. And it's hanging in the church, actually, in St. Peter's Church, where we grew up. And the church now owns those paintings, various scenes from the Bible. So he was already doing that before, but I think that there was a lot of stress in his life. His younger daughter, two daughters, was born with cerebral palsy, she has severe cerebral palsy. She's basically quadriplegic. And that puts a lot of stress on a life, and then you ask a lot of questions about where is God. But it didn't drive him from God, I think it drove him to God more. But there was always stress there, and I think the stress of, you know, having a disabled child, having to, you know, provide for family, it became a thing that he tried to do the best he could. He tried to be like Dad.
Tell people here about John Rankin.
Dr. John Rankin, he's the head of the Theological Education Institute in Connecticut. And he's one of the first people I met as a religion correspondent where you just kind of talk to, and he was just this wealth of information. And the first time I met him is when he was doing a debate with Dr. Jeremiah Wright. And many of you might remember, or maybe you're too young to know, Director, but I keep forgetting how old. But it would have been 8 years ago when President Obama or Barack Obama was running for president, or was in the first year of his presidency. And Dr. Jeremiah Wright was Barack Obama's pastor in Chicago, who had said some things like, you know, I won't repeat it, but, you know, he said some incendiary things about that somebody recorded in the context of a sermon and felt that this is what Barack Obama believed. And so Dr. Rankin invited Jeremiah Wright to a sort of debate about social issues and things. And so he decided to, fine, go out. And so so that was on the schedule. So, of course, all the news media is, you know, coming down to Connecticut for this debate. And because they want to hear Dr. Jeremiah Wright say something or interview him. And I was so impressed with what Dr. Rankin said and how he handled it and how he said, you know, you really do have to talk with people. You can't talk over them. You can't talk in sound bites. You have to respect the other person. He runs the Mars Hill organization, and then it's about asking the tough questions, but also really asking them in a way that's respectful and hearing the other person's side. And it just was a very, very eye-opening kind of encounter. And I remember having coffee with him one day, and he said, you know, and I wrote about this in the book, and he said, you know, I've met very few atheists. In fact, I don't think I've ever met an atheist. I've met a lot of people who are angry at God. And I think that's why I've always been impressed with him, because he's always been able to, he wants to take the hard questions. He wants to take people who don't agree with him and really respect them and love them and have a conversation.
Yeah, and you mentioned that at one point he's talking about LGBT issues.
He was debating against a lesbian in a room full of lesbians about LGBT issues. And at the end of the session, many of them came up to him and say, you know, I don't agree with you, but I respect you because you really care about us. And that just was a huge lesson about how you talk with people, how you love them first. You know, your intention can't be to win the argument if you lose the relationship. You always want to retain the relationship. Don't be so focused on winning the argument that you lose the relationship. And that's the lesson.
Yeah, he doesn't give an inch theologically.
Right, no, he doesn't.
But he says, we sinners rather than you sinners.
Right.
And that makes a big difference.
Right. I mean, this is something that, you know, Dr. Tim Keller talks about, you know, speak the truth in love. You know, if you're only speaking truth, you're going to get a lot of flack. You're just going to get a lot of, you know, conflict. But if you're only speaking love, you're not going to get anything. You know, you're just going, oh, whatever you want to do is fine, whatever. Somehow you got to find the sweet spot where it says you speak the truth in love, and you got to bring those two together. And that's harder to do. You know, and it takes work. It takes thought. It takes caring about the other person. It takes seeing them not as an object, but as a fellow human being, a fellow sinner in the eyes of God. And somehow you got to, like, see through all of that.
In the book, you talk about Hugh Ross, who is a creationist, actually an old earth creationist, but certainly not a Darwinian, and he's able to explain the scientific facts and do so, in a sense, as a happy warrior. So what have you learned from the way he's able to present things?
Well, first, he's very smart. But he's also, he's a scientist, but he's also a believer. And one of the first things he said, why he was transformed by the Bible, is because there was no other scripture, other holy book that he read that said, you know, you can test these things. I challenge you to test them. It's not like I want you not to test them. He said, you know, that's what drove him to really figuring out more what this Bible was about, this holy scripture was about. We sat in my office, and I've read some of his books as well, so it was just very interesting to hear him talk about his journey of faith and how, you know, you can look at the scripture differently from a different point of view, because so much of what we tend to do is kind of look at the Bible from the prism of a sort of 21st century sensibilities, and like, well, it doesn't say this, it doesn't say that. It's like, no, it doesn't say that. But this is what it says, and this is what it could mean. Leanne Cass wrote a great book called The Beginning of Wisdom, reading Genesis, and he basically says about the same thing. He says, you know, let's not talk about whether or not this actually happened at this time, at this specific date, or over these periods of days. He said, let's look at what the narrative is trying to say. Let's look at the wisdom. And one of the things I always remember he talked about in the book is that he said, it's not that Cain slew Abel per se, but it's that brothers always slay each other absent instruction from God. That this is not just that this happened, but this is what always happens. And the idea, and I know that Herbert Schlossberg talked about this, about Adam and Eve, is that if you take the temptation of the snake, to Eve, was that he was plying on the root of a seed that was already there. He nurtured something that was already there. And so this kind of putting my trust in myself is still with us today. You know, that sort of brokenness. So Hugh Ross is able to kind of grab onto things in the Bible that says, let's look at it from a scientific point of view, because these things actually do go together. Now, the narrative is different. You're not going to get the facts. You're not going to get specific things. But there's something here that is nominal and that applies to us.
So the history is real, but it's not just history as if that was then, this is now, and now is all that different.
Right. I mean, one of the things that, you know, ancient writings are about, we get to think, you know, we talk in terms of this is a fact, or we want information that sort of divvies up the when, what, where, why, and how, and, you know, the other, you know, and the ancient writing is much more concerned about function, about how this functions. It's this reason why we say the sun rises, even though we know the sun actually, you know, doesn't rise, it, you know, the earth rotates around it and the earth rotates on its axis. And that's how we get the idea that the sun rises. It, you know, so even though we know scientifically what happens, we still say the sun rises. And so the Bible kind of is an example of that. Sometimes it's not exactly specific of what it's trying to say. It's just trying to give you the function of what happened and what it means.
And it understands perspective. Which leads me to the next question. If you go online and check out Lauren, you'll see one particular interview that there's a lot of reference to, which was I thought a very good interview she did with a former or at one time Christian claimant, now turned Muslim, named Reza Aslan. Mm-hmm. And well, you asked a very simple question to Aslan, who had just come out with a book about Jesus: why are you as a Muslim writing about Jesus?
Right.
And then you can explain what happened there and the explosion.
Well,
after
it exploded. I mean, I really thought it was kind of a softball question, because as a scholar, you know, he would know the answer, and even as a Muslim, he would know the answer, and the answer was going to be very simple, this is what I expected back, because Muslims revere Jesus as a great prophet, but not as a divine son of God. Peace be upon him. The Quran mentions Mary, and very, very respectfully, as the mother of Jesus. And this is da da da. That's the conversation I expected to have, and that didn't come. And I think I got angry, and I think he got angry, and I realized that perhaps I had been set up to sell books, and that I kind of been. Because I had interviewed him before, and no such thing ever happened. And so this particular time, and I really did feel like he had to answer his critics, because there had been things written about it from Christian standpoint, and I really wanted him to answer those questions. But I wanted to give him the softball issue to say, I respect Jesus, even as a Muslim. Muslims respect Jesus. That was the question. That was where we were supposed to start. Now you're going to answer your critics. And however dispassionately you want to do, I thought the response was going to be, I know that they think that this is the way Muslims feel, but they're writing from a Christian perspective. I don't see it that way, and millions of Muslims don't see it that way, and we're just not going to get together on this, because that's what, and it just never got to that point. And it was very unsettling, and I didn't, you know, it was .com, and maybe about 100 people probably saw it at that point. And then 2 days later, it like explodes on the internet. I'm like, what just happened? So, but you know, I mean, this was another case, and this was another case where John Rankin's words really spoke to me.
Okay.
Later. I said, you know, you focused so much on winning the argument that you lost the relationship, and I should have been smarter that way, and I wasn't. And that is my one biggest regret from that.
Okay. What's been, thinking back, what's your all-time favorite interview that you've done?
I think an interview that probably had the most impact on my life was a minister out of Chicago and his wife, who had lost their 6 youngest children in a fiery car accident.
I know them, yeah.
Yes, and he had incredible faith. And he said he listened to very often the Spafford hymn, It Is Well With My Soul. And I think that just was so transforming. I think I always go back to that interview when people ask me, you know, that stands out to me as something so powerful. Because, you know, Spafford lost his 4 daughters, or I think it was 4 daughters, or in a boating accident as they crossed the Atlantic. And it gave great solace to this minister out of Chicago who had lost 6 of his kids. I mean, the baby was not even, I don't think, a few weeks old. They still had cards from the baby shower. And all six of them died, I think, were from like 6 months old. No, not like 6 weeks old, maybe. I don't know, a few weeks old to like 12 years old. All six of them died. And it was the freakiest accident and yet accident. And they brought us in their homes. They showed me their beds. And he said, you know, we're going to praise God. That, to me, was incredible.
He wrote also a wonderful children's book. Because one of the children who died really loved baseball.
Yeah.
And he wrote a children's book, and it's very moving. At the beginning of the book, there's the lineup, a lineup card, if you see this in baseball, where it has nine players, and he lists all the nine, including the six who were killed.
Yeah.
Right there.
Nobody wants to go through that. And nobody wants to be chosen to go through that. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with thinking, you know, maybe I could win the lottery and then, you know, you could get billions of dollars. And I'm thinking, you know what, there is a lottery in life. Sometimes the lottery, you know, gives you things like an accident, and I don't want to win that kind of lottery. Nobody wants to win. Nobody wants to experience that kind of pain and grief. But when it happens, you just have to, you can't run away. And I talk about this in the book. You want to grow closer to God, but God, is there another way? You know, this is Jesus' words as he's going to the cross. He knows he's going to die. He knows this is going to be this eternal cosmic separation from the Father. He's experiencing it in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's experiencing the first pains of that separation, just like, you know, when you're going to go to something, you know the stress is coming, you know the hurt's coming, you know something's happening. He's experiencing this on a cosmic level, and yet he went to the cross. And so when we experience it, it's like, if you remember that sort of thing, it's like, I don't want to experience it, but God, give me the strength.
If you could interview anyone from the Old Testament, who would you want to interview?
I've been thinking about this.
Excellent. I gave you a little warning. So.
Yeah, it's really the same. It's the same answer, because it is Moses. Because of the, although Joseph might be in there too, just because how was it like in prison for so many years and you didn't have any word from God and, you know, you thought you were this, like, you know, the toast of the town here, and you're now in prison. But I think Moses is particularly interesting because of the Ten Commandments, because I talk about the Ten Commandments, because the book is focused on, you know, the first commandment, the light, the first commandments being on top of them like a lighthouse. The young woman that was with us before, Kendra, and I was talking to her about a scene from the movie The Ten Commandments and how that just strikes my mind about how when Pharaoh sends Moses out into the desert and gets him, you know, he says, go find your, you know, go be king to the scorpions and the snakes out there. And if your God saves you, then fine. If not, you know, die, basically. And then the monologue on top of that starts to talk about how he was, you know, beaten and into the dust. And then it shows Moses kind of like, you know, clamoring and dust and just crawling along the ground and finally just gives up. And then the monologue says, you know, finally, when you were beaten into the dust that you came from, the clay is now ready for the maker's hand. And I think that's so powerful, that sometimes we get into, like, why is life like this? Why can't I do this? And sometimes brokenness is the only way God can kind of first get our attention, but also take ourselves out of the mix so that he can really do his best work.
And what would you ask Moses particularly?
What would I ask Moses? So what was it like, Moses, at the burning bush? I mean, what did it look like? I mean, because what did it, tell me exactly what it was like up there on Mount Sinai. You know, just, I mean, and also, what were your early years like? Did you think, when did you finally realize that something was different about you? At one point in your life, did you know that you were a Hebrew? And that, did you ever hate yourself for it? Did you ever wonder why that you'd been, that you were different, that you weren't living with your people? I mean, or did you not want to live with your people? I mean, there's so many things the Bible really doesn't say, like how he was thinking and what was going on. I would really want to know. I mean, it's a great personal story. It's one of the longest lives narrated in the Bible.
Okay, New Testament person.
Oh, New Testament, besides Jesus?
Besides Jesus. Because Sunday school, we know what the answer is, but
yes,
besides that.
Yeah, because that Jesus would be the first, but I think would be the Apostle Paul. I really think. I mean, I'm really totally captivated by transformed lives. You know, and the idea that some people, Jesus always meets us where we need to be met. You know, and this is a Dr. Kellerism. It's sometimes we need a sermon, sort of a soft sermon to kind of, you know, bring us along. Sometimes we need just, you know, hard facts, a slap in the face. You know, this is Jesus. This is God. And sometimes you just need a revelation, flash of light, and Jesus coming, I'm here. And this is, I think, so powerful about the Apostle Paul, and here he is, the major writer of the New Testament, and he knew the Hebrew Scriptures so well, and was able to sort of understand them in light of now Jesus' appearance as Messiah. And I think that is just, I just want to learn, because it's like, okay, was there a letter you didn't write that you should have written, that you wanted to write, that you haven't written, that maybe we should, you know, add to the New Testament?
Okay. And what question would you ask Jesus?
I wouldn't ask him anything. I would just thank you. You know, Easter Sunday, you know, have you ever seen the Pietà at the Basilica in Rome? The Pietà with Mary holding Jesus off the cross. And there's a replica of it at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. And at times I've stared at it, and I look there, and there is the picture of love, of a man broken, laying in the arms of his mother. And I'm thinking, what would it be like to see Jesus on the cross and see that picture of love of this broken body? And on Easter Sunday, sometimes I think all I want to do is crawl up and just lay under the cross and just be thankful. That's all I want. I wouldn't want to ask him anything. I mean, did Job ask God anything when he said, you know, now you question me? It's like, no, I have nothing to ask. I think being in the presence of Jesus, every question will be asked. To someone who can peer inside your soul and see everything that you are, every hurt, every pain, every longing, every need, every fault, and just love you down to your deepest soul. There is no question I need to ask after that. That is the answer to everything.
That was religion reporter and author Lauren Green speaking with World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky. This interview took place in March of 2017 at Patrick Henry College. Thank you for listening to this presentation of listener-supported World Radio. I'm Jill Nelson. See you next time.